From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I talk about the first woman to win math's Nobel Prize equivalent, the Fields Medal, and North Korea's missile test this week as Pope Francis visits South Korea.
You had more people baptized in the Catholic faith in Asia last year than you had in Europe, so there's been a significant shift, and this Pope is aware of that and is going as a symbolic gesture to Catholics in that area.
And later, I'm joined by classical Persian scholar Austin O'Malley. He says the language's stability drew him to study centuries-old Near Eastern poetry.
Compared to English, it's changed less over the last 1,000 years. So even with just 1 year of Persian, you can read, for example, the quatrains of Khayyam or some of Rumi's poetry.
Exploring Persia's ancient literature after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca Cruz, some interesting news about the Fields Medal. It's the Nobel Prize equivalent in math. It's given every 4 years. It's a very prestigious award. Only 52 winners before now. All of them have been men. And this year, for the first time this week, it was awarded to a woman. And this is incredible, not just because it was awarded to a woman for the first time, but an Iranian-born woman, a woman from the Middle East, Mariam Mirzakhani. Educated in Iran, came to Harvard for her PhD as a professor at Stanford. So now there's, you know, all of this excitement about this, thinking this is going to be a huge motivation for women in the future to study STEM fields, the science, technology, engineering, math fields, that there's been this big push for women for a long time. But not only that, women coming from the Middle East, that there will be a big push on that. What is your take on this, Rebecca? Are we to really celebrate this for all the things it is beyond just this one woman winning this award?
Well, I think the other thing that we might add to this is that the award ceremony was in South Korea, and she was actually handed the medal by the female president of South Korea, their first female leader there. So we have kind of a double instance of female first. But yes, I do think that role modeling is incredibly important. Women need to see other women, or I guess young girls need to see women in political positions, in positions of authority, in scientific fields, in those sorts of areas, because you have to be able to see what you might look like, see how you might be able to fill that position. The fact that she's an Iranian woman, I think, is, as you mentioned, particularly significant for women in the Middle East, but even here, women in the United States who can see a woman who is not white, who's of another ethnicity, and they can try to emulate that.
I think your comment about role modeling is particularly important, as this week there's also been discussion about the space program and the need for women and minorities in the space program, and how since the shuttle program, in fact, of the 80s, there began this instance. I mean, before that, it was always for white men and, you know, astronauts. If you wanted to study anything scientific, if you wanted to be an astronaut, you had to be a white man who could become a pilot. And it wasn't until the shuttle program in the 80s when they began to integrate and women and minorities joined the program. I wonder if this, you know, very similarly might be quite motivating for young people who, you know, look at something like math, for example, and say, this just isn't for me. There aren't that many, you know, female professors that are mathematicians. There aren't that many women that are in the science, technology, and engineering fields that are women. So it really is critical, I think, around the world to see that role modeling going on, and particularly for ethnic women, women mm-hmm. from other parts of the world.
Well, and I think especially young girls. There was another story this summer about Lego for the very first time creating miniatures of female scientists. And this was in reaction to a letter a young girl sent. It's a Danish company, Lego. And they have sold off the shelf. So there's this role modeling starting very, very early on. And that's very important, very significant.
Definitely a global phenomenon. Well, connecting our two stories, actually, you mentioned how the South Korean president, a pioneer woman herself, honored the winner of the Fields Medal. Let's talk a little bit about South Korea, in particular, Pope Francis's first visit to Asia. He's in South Korea. He's there for several reasons, to beatify more than 100 Koreans who died in the 18th and 19th centuries. He's also attending Asia Youth Day, but he's also using his role as a diplomat to urge reconciliation and healing on the Korean Peninsula. This is a wonderful thing that popes do. They go out and travel the world and they highlight these very important issues. But yet the North Koreans responded in a rather negative way. They fired 3 rockets as the Pope's plane was even approaching Korean airspace, and then another 2 later in the day. I mean, this maybe leads us to believe there isn't much hope for reconciliation in the case of North and South Korea.
Well, that's obviously a long conflict between the two. And after the situation in Ukraine, any time that we see rockets going into the air towards a – not even towards an airplane, but in the vicinity of an airplane, it makes us a little bit nervous. But it doesn't appear that at any time the Pope was targeted or that his life was in danger. And I think the North Koreans picked this moment because they knew it would be on the news. They have said that this is in reaction to U.S.-South Korean military exercises that will be going on next week. As you mentioned, though, this is the Pope's first visit there. In fact, it's actually the first time since 1989 that a Pope has been to South Korea, and Pope Benedict really didn't go to Asia at all. So Pope Francis has indicated that he's going to be returning at least two times in the upcoming year to the Philippines and Sri Lanka and elsewhere potentially. So it's kind of a pivot to Asia being made by our Pope. And there's a couple of reasons for that, but one of the most significant is that you have a growing Catholic population in Asia, particularly in South Korea, about 10% of the population now. The Philippines is a majority Catholic population because of their colonial history. You had more people baptized in the Catholic faith in Asia last year than you had in Europe. So there's been a significant shift, and this Pope is aware of that and is going as a symbolic gesture to Catholics in that area.
Well, he also reached out to China before he left about their role in Asia, and particularly their role as supporting a growing Catholic population there. I don't know if it'll make much headway on that, but the Chinese did allow the Pope's plane to fly through their airspace, and I think that was somewhat remarkable as well. So we'll see if that Asian pivot that hasn't happened in many other places might begin from the Vatican.
We will definitely see. I think we'll see the Pope in Asia many times in the coming years.
Well, Rebecca, as always, thank you so much for being here, for your insight and analysis.
Thank you.
We're interested in your thoughts about this conversation, and we'll answer any questions you may have. Leave your feedback on our website at kgou.org or send it to us on Twitter. We're at Worldviews KGOU or at Suzette Grelot and at Cruise 226. Next, I'll talk about the poetry of ancient Persia with the University of Chicago's Austin O'Malley. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Today I'm joined by Austin O'Malley. He's a PhD student at the University of Chicago studying Islamic history and civilization, but he focuses specifically on ancient poetry and the Persian language. Austin O'Malley, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
So in your work as a doctoral student, right, you're currently a doctoral student at the University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And so your work is focusing on pre-modern Persian religious poetry. So tell us a little bit about pre-modern Persian poetry. What is it about poetry from that era that is important to us?
Well, Persian has a very rich literary tradition stretching back to the 9th century, I mean, over 1,000 years. And it's also very varied. We have lots of different kinds of poetry. Court poetry was very popular. Lots of panegyric.
You say court poetry?
Yes. Poetry written for a patron. So you would praise the patron. You would praise the patron's good qualities and hope for some reward for this. And this is really where most of the more formally complex types of Persian poetry began. They began as courtly forms. But by the 12th century, they had also a lot of poetry had become to be more mystically focused and religiously focused. And so my particular area of interest is in poetry that has some sort of mystical content or used for some sort of religious or mystical purpose. So the figure I'm working on mostly, his name is Attar, and he wrote in a lot of different forms. And he would write very long sorts of poems of rhyming couplets that have various sorts of stories in them with moral points or religious points. There's also some of the listeners might be familiar with Rumi, Maulana Rumi. He's very popular these days. He's probably the most famous sort of Persian poet that people might have heard of. And he is famous. He also wrote Masnavis like Attar, but he's famous for these lyrical poems.
So can you give us an example of a poem from this era that would kind of illustrate what you're working with here?
Yeah. So I have a poem I'd like to share by Omar Khayyam. And this is a quatrain. So it's a very short poem, sort of two verses, four hemistiches. And this was originally a sort of folk form of poetry. So these would be recited orally, composed orally, and would be transmitted orally. And then later they would be – often would be collected in written form. Omar Khayyam is famous for having theme, sort of Epicurean themes in his poems and meditations on mortality and death and how to live a life that is meaningful or has some purpose or direction in the face of knowing that – in the face of uncertainty, really, and mortality and temporality. So the poem is as follows. Be kar gahe kuzegari raftam dush. دیدم دو هزار کوزه گویا و خاموش ناگه یکی در آورد خروش کو کوزیگارو کوزیخارو کوزه فروش.
And what is the translation? What does this poem mean?
The translation is last night I went to the workshop of the potter and I saw 2,000 clay vases which would have been used for wine, kuze. I saw 2,000 kuze. And some were silent and some were speaking. And one of them suddenly let out a cry, whereas the potter and the person who sells the pot and the person who buys the pot. It's sort of a meditation on the fact that everyone living passes away and we just leave these traces. And the wine jug is an especially important symbol for.
So that's what's going to ask about the symbolism here of the pottery or of the vase itself, particularly the vase for wine, that this is somehow symbolic and meaningful
so this is a sense and
obviously tells us something about the culture of the day.
Right. So the wine jug is a very important sort of image for Khayyam, both because he often would recommend that you seize the moment, you drink wine, you enjoy your brief time here on earth before it inevitably ends and you don't know what's going to happen afterwards. And it also has another layer of meaning because he'll often like to talk about how after we die and our bodies become dust, they might then be molded into clay and then your body might become a piece of a wine jug for someone else.
So your life goes on in some meaningful and, or at least enjoyable way,
I suppose.
Bringing enjoyment to others.
Often many of his poems have a sort of meditative quality, I would say.
So in terms of a meditative quality, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that
using it in some way to.
Yeah, in the sense that he would recommend that you sort of approach the present in a sort of contemplative way, knowing that it will end. And thinking about the end of life that is coming can actually make the present more meaningful in a certain way. Mm-hmm. So he'll call on his readers. He'll exhort them to sort of drink wine and think about as they're pressing the wine jug to their lips to think about how this may have been someone else before who was also drinking wine.
I'm speaking with University of Chicago classical Persian scholar Austin O'Malley. More of our conversation right after a break. I'm Suzette Gralat, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gralat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Today I'm joined by Austin O'Malley, a Near East historian who studies classical Persian poetry at the University of Chicago. Just before the break, he read a quatrain by Omar Khayyam and said the poet's contemplative approach to the end of life can make readers appreciate the present. So in addition to the actual words that these poets create, can you tell us a little bit about the poets themselves and their lives and the impact that they have? Obviously, Rumi, as you mentioned, a very mm-hmm. famous poet, the one you just quoted here, Attar, others. I mean, particularly in Persia, the lives that they led and the impact that they had on their community at that time, but also mm-hmm. today, how they mm-hmm. really resonate
yeah,
with the community today.
Sure. Well, it's very for the first part of the question about their impact on their communities historically. With some poets, it's very difficult to know. With others, it's easier to know. So the poem that I just read was by Khayyam, and we do know about a historical Khayyam, who is a philosopher and a mathematician, but we don't really know about him as a poet. In fact, the earliest manuscripts we have do not mention him as a poet at all. But then 100, 200 years after his death, all these compilations start appearing of these short quatrains. So it's a little bit difficult to know if he actually even wrote them or he wrote a few and he became famous for them. And then maybe people felt like these short poems about mortality and doubt and not really uncertainty about life and its course really resonated with them. And they started composing more poems like this and simply assigning his name to them. So there's sort of a growing corpus of these poems with these sorts of themes. Khayyam is very popular today too, though, in Iran. It's very common to see people have memorized a number of poems by Khayyam. Collections of his poems are in all the bookstores and sold everywhere. So these sort of short little meditations on death that are not totally religious, I mean, they're not totally orthodox. And he does talk about how, you know, you should enjoy life now because you don't know if these stories of heaven are just stories or if they're true. So he'll have famous poems where he'll talk about, I would rather take some cash now than a loan, promise of some credit in the future, by which he means stories of heaven and paradise. So these are actually very popular in Iran right now. And
well, what draws people to this? I mean, obviously contemplating and meditating, mm-hmm. as you're saying, on these issues of life and death are universal in nature. I mean, is this sure. really what kind of draws the community to it? And how accessible are these poems outside of the Persian world, outside of the Persian language? Mm-hmm. Are they widely known and understood and read elsewhere?
Yeah, I think so. With Khayyam, he was sort of discovered, you know, by the West in the Victorian period by Fitzgerald, a British poet, who was interested in foreign languages. He had learned some Persian, and he found a manuscript of Khayyam's poems and translated them into sort of wonderful English quatrains. And you can still get his copies, his translations today. And so he was really drawn to sort of the more agnostic aspects of them. And he became quite popular. He really resonated with people of that age. And in the U.S. as well, you know, there were Omar Khayyam like dinner clubs popping up where people would gather, you know, Omar Khayyam societies throughout that period, the period of World War One, were really very popular. So yeah, he does resonate with people today as well. And of course, we had mentioned Rumi earlier, who is a very different sort of poet. He's a religious poet. He's a mystical poet.
So in what way can you describe Rumi's poetry for
sure.
us a little bit in terms of the ways in which he's a mystical or religious
poet? Yeah, so Rumi
poet.
Is most famous for his ghazal poetry, which is a lyric, essentially. It can sort of be compared to a sonnet, maybe, in terms of form, an English sonnet. Usually they're between 7 and 14, 15 lines. And they're on sort of romantic themes, let's say, or amatory themes. So often they're describing a beloved, and the poet is speaking as the lover, describing his love for the beloved. And in Rumi's poems, this is often sort of understood as a divine beloved. So he's describing his love for God, using language that was developed for earlier court poetry, but he's now deploying it for religious or mystical purposes. And he's quite popular in the U.S. today too, especially in sort of New Age groups.
In terms of his popularity in Iran, I mean, you can't help but have a conversation with anybody from that part of the world where they refer to the importance of Rumi in today's cultural context. I mean, this really does seem to help us understand the Persian world today, particularly the Iranian
mm-hmm,
people.
Mm-hmm. I mean, poetry is still very much, I would say it's much more important to the fabric of daily life in Iran today than it is in the U.S. So people will memorize poems, recite poems at parties or gatherings.
Is that just some sort of significant cultural difference, you think, where they're still very much attached to artists of that sort, poets, where you actually have a poetry reading and, you know,
I think it's just
private gatherings, unlike what you might expect.
I think it's just a different, different cultures have different forms. This is such a lame answer. I'm sorry. But yes, poetry is I think it's just simply a more important art form in Iran than it is in the U.S. right now.
Well, I have to end just by asking you how you became interested in this pre-modern Persian poetry. Where did that come from?
You know, it really first came from foreign language study. So I started taking Persian language courses when I was in college, my last year of college. And it was really very exciting to me to see some progress in a foreign language and to be able to speak it even just a little bit, you know, that first year. And what's quite interesting too is that particularly the Persian language compared to English, it's changed less over the last 1,000 years, let's say. So even with just 1 year of Persian, you can read, for example, the quatrains of Khayyam or some of Rumi's poetry. So very early I got a taste for it. And that was very exciting on a personal level and also sort of enlightening when you start seeing how language – or literature works in a foreign language. It also provides maybe some new insights to your own language and your own culture, and you start thinking about how it's put together in a deeper sort of way.
Well, I think that's a great point to end on, that through our studies of other cultures, we become more enlightened about our own cultures. So that's a great lesson to learn, I think. So, well, thank you very much for that insight.
Thank you.
Been listening to my conversation with Austin O'Malley, a classical Persian scholar and PhD candidate at the University of Chicago. There's more information online at kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Symphony Swift prepares the research for our interviews and books our guests. Hallie Arias built out this episode for our website, and Brian Herdzinski produces the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.